Sourcing Matters Podcast. This is your host, Aaron Niederhellman, sharing stories of our food. And welcome back to Sourcing Matters. This is your host, Aaron Niederhellman. Did you know that land trusts have conserved 56 million acres across the lower 48 states? That's an area of protected land that is double the size of all land in national parks. For some scale, 56 million acres is about the size of Minnesota. To help digest that, in 2015, in total, state, local, and national land trusts voluntarily conserved an average of 5,000 acres per day, or 1.8 million acres for the year. When you start to assess the what if when you engage proper land and ecological management practice on these parcels, we're talking huge impact, maybe even huge impact, and the potential proving grounds for land restoration initiatives at scale. Effectively, a learning lab for our planet. Then, if you ramp up even further, and we look at federally owned lands, the U.S. federal government owns 640 million acres of land in the United States, about 28% of the land area, which accounts for about 2.27 billion acres. The majority of federal lands are administered by the Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, National Park Service, and U.S. Forest Service. Now, mind you, 61% of Alaska landmass is federally owned, which significantly inflates these numbers. But since by all accounts, climate change is inevitable and much of the permafrost in the Arctic North will defrost, we're going to include it for this conversation. Now, will that carbon, methane, and other greenhouse gases remain banked in these grounds or be off-gassed? That remains to be seen. It may come down to the management of these virgin soils. Alternatively, could we further engage this awoken and living soil, once defrosted, to sequester more with optimal regenerative management practices? Well, that also remains to be seen. Back to the numbers of our common grounds. If you throw in the another 11.4 million acres operated by the Department of Defense, which I will, since virtually every DOD report on national security in the last two decades includes climate change as a clear and present danger, then we're talking about the potential of big impact. In fact, the collective represents over 30% of U.S. lands that could be affixed to sequestering carbon, cleaning water cycle, engaging ecological services, growing our food, and developing natural resources and energy independence, all by remediating climate change. Talk about a great way to re-enter the Paris Agreement with a splash. And we're here with a plan, a Green New Deal starting with the pillar of land management. Soon enough, it's our time to help spearhead this fight and engage land to be our ground zero here in the United States. Today, we welcome a guest diligently working to pool together best practices and procedures that engage regenerative natural resources in the fight against climate change and sea level rise. How, when we get our house in order, and our executive branch too, that we'll be ready. Today, we welcome a leader at the intersection of agriculture and the environment, Greg Horner. Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Good afternoon. Great to be here.
Hey, it's our pleasure to welcome you. We both live up in the North Shore of Massachusetts, not too far from the recording studio down here in Cambridge.
Right.
Right?
Yep. Good to be here.
Good. Well, hey, it's not too far for us to get here and hang out. We get to hang up in the North Shore. Now we hang out down here in Cambridge, talk about the same stuff. So Greg, let's talk about that lead in a bit. I paint a picture that land and natural resources may be one of our biggest assets stateside in the fight on climate change. Is that accurate? And what will it take for us to leverage this asset in a timely fashion?
It's absolutely accurate, and I find it really exciting because there's so much attention and energy that goes into addressing all the other issues. Everyone thinks about solar and wind and electric vehicles and hybrids as a way as our path out of this, but we can't reach the Paris Accord, the limits that are the goals of the Paris Accord, without including soil carbon. And the carbon that is attributed to land management is equal to the electricity sector in size. So there was actually a blog by Bill Gates a month or so ago pointing out, and I don't agree with all of his positions, but pointing out, hey, everyone should be paying more attention to soil health as part of our solution to climate change.
I mean, it's essential. And I think what's been interesting is in the mainstream media, carbon has been made out to be the enemy. Carbon is just part of the natural cycle. And what we have to do is find better ways of putting it where it should be involved, which is in the living soil.
Yes, carbon in the air is the problem. Carbon in the soil is perhaps, it is part of the solution. And if you think about the amount of carbon that can be stored in the soil, it's like imagine a bathtub that's half empty, that there's all this potential to fill that bathtub back up with carbon that historically was in the soil.
Okay. So we'll talk a bit more about what are the vessels we use to get that carbon back into the soil in a few. But let me read a little more of your background, and then we'll jump into those questions. Greg Horner is an independent consultant for Greg Horner Consulting. It's funny, you got the same name as the guy that owns the place. That's amazing. Horner is best known for his work in partnering with foundations, individuals, donors, and nonprofits to help them advance sustainability, regenerative agriculture, soil health, rural economies, and positive role for agriculture in addressing environmental issues. Partners include the McKnight Foundation, Tomcat Ranch, Regenerative Agriculture Foundation, and Armonia LLC. Also, Greg is an agriculture and environmental advisor to a PBS Nova film production on carbon sequestration. So you work with some of the most progressive and well-known philanthropic givers and impact investors who are focused on the intersection of how we'll feed ourselves in the future and the impact on the environment. So from your point of view, is this still a fringe element, or are we making headway with the general public, with the eaters themselves?
There is a lot of increased recognition of the value of soil carbon and about the role that eaters can play. Really, though, it comes down to recognition across the various parts of the system, from the producers to the policymakers to the consumers, of the importance of how we treat our soil. I think it's a paradigm shift from a chemistry perspective to a biology perspective, that historically soil was looked at as a lifeless or mostly lifeless medium that was used, and you could inject it with the fertilizers, and herbicides, whatever the plant needed, as just the soil would hold the roots and deliver the nutrients. And over time, and recently, there's been more and more awareness and understanding of how by treating the soil as a living biology and fostering a living soil, we're able to achieve these multiple benefits to the yield of the plants, to the ability of plants to fight back against diseases and pests, and also the ability to create a soil sponge that holds carbon and holds moisture. And that moisture, that ability to infiltrate and hold on to water, is one of the best climate adaptation tools. Being able to deal with the sudden rainfalls, the 6-inch rainfalls over a couple day period, which happen more and more frequently, and be able to take that water, infiltrate it in, not only helps prevent the drought a few weeks down the road, but also protects the runoff that is going to damage the waterways and also lose that precious topsoil that's needed for growing the next round of crops.
Everything from the practice and the procedure we've been taught, it's the chemistry test. That's how you check soil.
Right. NPK.
NPK. That's right. The macronutrients, the rest of it will take care of itself. And maybe we were at a point where we had such scale and such an abundance of natural resources, specifically in this country, that we didn't have to worry about those things. But really, we are at a point where we are having to figure out or look at what that soil health really represents. And what's intriguing in looking at that, we had Fred Kirschman on that told us that, you know, in one tablespoon of soil, there's more living microbes than there are people on the planet. 7 billion microbes in one tablespoon of soil. so, and they all have this nutrient cycling program, this ecological system that took 3 billion years to do this. And in one generation, maybe two generations, we are wiping this out. Are we at a loss, or is there something we can do about fixing some of these problems?
We certainly have things we can do, and really it's exciting to see the strength of what I would refer to as the soil health movement. There are lots of signs that this is a movement or even a revolution in agriculture. There are major trade magazines, there's conferences, there's trade associations that are saying, hey, soil health, this is a big thing. It hasn't become political. Everyone can find a way to want to support soil health, and opportunities abound for starting with simple steps. The no-till, the move to no-till agriculture has been very successful. The planting of cover crops, the rate has skyrocketed in some places of the country, in pockets, but it's really taking off. So I think there are a lot of positive signs.
No doubt about it. I mean, looking at where the individuals that are in the soil health movement have started to assess this, I think you're right. It's not a political conversation. They're actually looking at this as a pragmatic approach. They're getting producers involved in this because it's less expensive. Actually, it's a better approach to raising crops or animals. It's a better investment. There's a longer horizon. It builds resilience, to your point about what we can do for water retention or preservation of land. So I think it's interesting because the soil health movement is taking into account the diverse stakeholders involved in this, and finding incentives for them to partake is a collective. That's very different than the political climate movement, I think, that
Indeed.
Maybe we've learned a bit on this, right?
Yeah. And so much of the focus in conventional agriculture, in mainstream agriculture, all agriculture, has been about increasing the yields. But at the end of the day, what matters to producers is their net, their ability to stay in business, their ability to be a viable farm business is their net. So a lot of the regenerative agriculture techniques, a lot of the soil health methods don't necessarily increase your yield, but they increase your net. They decrease the inputs that you need in the soil. They might decrease the number of tractor passes or the amount of herbicide or the amount of nitrogen-based fertilizers that you're applying.
And we stop mining those resources over a long period of time, right? I mean, we really are in a situation where if we keep taking from this soil vitality, then what does that leave for tomorrow of your crops or your kids' crops? Or what are we going to do in looking at this? And when we're at 7 billion people and we're doing this at such gross scale, that seems to be really the 800-pound gorilla here, is that our practices, some of these Western practices of a conventional agriculture system, are now spreading across, mm-hmm. that we have to make a transformative change in order to preserve that soil health.
Yeah, and small tweaks aren't going to do it, but a new way, a new paradigm, a new approach. The problem sometimes with science and the way they look at some of these producers is conventional science wants to have a small number of variables and have one plot next to another and change one thing. And oftentimes it doesn't yield the results that they're looking for. It doesn't show anything very positive or enthusiastic or exciting. But if you have, when you have systems like Gabe Brown, I know you've had Gabe on the show, he's changing multiple things. It's a more of a holistic approach, and it makes it challenging to sit back and study that and use data and analysis to see what it was that made the change. But it wasn't just one thing. It's sort of like a person changing their diet and changing their exercise and their living conditions. All of a sudden that person's healthier, and it's not just one thing. We're such a reductionist culture sometimes. We wanna look for that silver bullet. What's the one thing that we can do to change? It's really more of a silver buckshot approach, and that's true with climate change. And the role of soil carbon is one of multiple important pieces. And one reason why I'm such an advocate for it is that it's one that's gotten the least amount of attention. Hmm. So there's so much opportunity. There's much more opportunity there in elevating that as a strategy than other areas that already have a lot of attention and investment and programs and government promotion.
Looking at your work and the folks that you work with, that elevating that conversation to a systems thinking approach, that, look, we are part of an overall system, the more we get out of this reductionist approach to try to find one small tweak, but really start to look at how these ecological systems really work without us. Boy, when we're actually flipped that, we actually can help optimize that to be part of this solution, then some good things can happen. And it's been interesting from what I've read in your reports, you've been working on a series of land management profiles which explore our role in proper management practice, specifically the impact of putting, somewhere, not specifically, but including putting grazing animals back out on pasture as a vessel for net positive environmental results. Can you please tell us more about the series of profiles that you're working on?
Yeah, absolutely. This has been a fascinating project. And I'll just, as a little preface, I'll say, if the soil carbon sequestration is much larger than the grazing piece. So I'm going to talk about the role of grazing as one tool to promote soil carbon and really to promote soil health. I've been working in partnership with Tomcat Ranch and the Tomcat Ranch Foundation out in California to interview, to prepare a series of profiles of public lands and agency staff that are using grazing as a tool to promote soil health. There's lots of public land, there's lots of agencies that have been using grazing for decades, longer, for over a century. As long as public lands have been around and these agencies, grazing has been an important part of it. But there's a perception of grazing as being environmentally damaging, and it can be, and in many places it is. Who was it? Rid Shin on the show who used the phrase, it's not the cow, it's the how. And I was going to mention that as well. It's a great phrase because it's not fair to blame the cow. It's the human beings managing the herd that bear the blame for degrading a landscape or the praise for improving it. So what we're doing, what I'm doing with Tomcat, is interviewing the agency staff, learning about their work and their stories, how they're using grazing, the challenges, the opportunities they see, what they've learned, and the results they've seen from a few years of doing this. And it's been hugely interesting and really inspiring. Very impressed by the public servants that I've spoken to, their dedication, their thoughtfulness. And it's been great collecting these stories. It's a series that will be coming out later this summer. I've spoken to state parks, Department of Conservation.
And these are all over the country too.
Yeah, right? Wisconsin, yeah. Colorado, Missouri, several in California, a project in high elevation, Wyoming. Really interesting stories and producers. It's been a fascinating project.
And these are, from what I saw, the initial release of the profiles, which haven't been released yet, but some large swaths of land, 25,000 acres in some circumstances.
Yes. The projects range in size quite dramatically, but even one of them was up 1 million acres. That was in Wyoming, where the Chevron Oil Company had a series of pipeline construction and then oil and gas drilling sites that got degraded from heavy machinery. You can imagine a site with a drilling pad and all the equipment there. And then once they were finished with that site and they wanted to sort of pack up and move on, the Bureau of Land Management, which owned the land, required them to restore that site to perennial vegetation. To native vegetation. So in order to close their permit and move on to a new site, they had to restore perennial grasses. Chevron tried spraying herbicides, planting to kill the weeds, and then seeding perennial grasses, but it wasn't working. And this is 12,000 feet, like 6 inches of rain a year, really challenging soils to work in. So they were getting very frustrated and wasting a lot of time and money. Eventually, they hired, and it's still hard to imagine for me, Chevron saying, great, we're going to hire this company called Goat Green. We're going to hire a company to bring in 1,500 goats to restore perennial grasses. And they were moving them multiple times a day. This herd, 1,500 goats packed in to a really small space, and they would just mow through everything in sight. They much prefer weeds to grasses, goats. This is the only of the profiles that's focused on goats. But here's a story where Bureau of Land Management said, all right, Chevron, you want to try this? Go right ahead. Be our guest. We don't think it's going to work, but go right ahead. And the Goat Green folks were able to demonstrate restoring perennial grasses with their goats. And over 10 years, it was so successful, they kept getting annual contracts from Chevron. Over 10 years, they grazed 1 million acres of pipeline corridors and drilling sites, shifting the vegetation from noxious weeds to biennials and then to perennials, to a place where they're able to walk away and move on to the next site.
Fascinating, right? And I mean, speaking of that systems thinking approach to it here, which I know you're looking at the practice and the management and what that can mean for either restoration or preservation. But that also creates a byproduct, which is some pretty good quality, healthy meat, right? I mean, there's another opportunity, which may be more connected to some of our listening audience around grass-fed meat, which has become more mainstream in market share.
Indeed. And actually, the rest of the profiles, every other one of the profiles is an example where a public agency is partnering with private grazers from the area who are contracted to come in and graze their animals for very specific periods and according to a plan that's drawn up in partnership with the agency staff. And the goals are what drive it. So really the agency staff are managers saying, we need to have disturbance on these sites. And most of us who are not in agriculture would think disturbance is a bad thing. But landscapes are evolved with disturbance. You think about the grasslands in the middle of the country, they evolved over a long period of time where those grasses were not just getting tall and being uneaten and turning into forests. There were large herds of grazing buffalo, for the most part, who were eating the grasses, trampling the grasses, which is just as important, leaving behind manure, using their hooves to break the crust of the soil, to press the seeds into the soil. So a lot of these land managers are trying to use grazing in a way that replicates the disturbance, the historical disturbance that provided by the herds of wild grazers.
Interesting. And well put and well explained. It was interesting to hear from Alan Savory, who was one of the first characters involved in understanding what happened in some of the African plains, sub-Saharan plains, and by taking some of their, not meat animals, but their pastoral animals off of it, what happened for desertification. Mm-hmm. And we've seen it, as you said, in the Southwest here in the United States, taking the buffalo herds off and what the impact is. So the fact that we're looking at these practices, but I think it's been a learning experience along that way. You just can't just make these animals go out and get on a pasture, right? There's an approach to moving these animals around, replicating predators. How much have you studied this in your profiles?
Absolutely. I'm glad you brought that up. It's important to distinguish between a continuous grazing model, which is used in many places across the country, and on most, I'd say the majority of public lands, like Bureau of Land Management land, will have cattle that are turned out to a large area and basically left there for long periods, and they are free to roam where they want and graze where they want. The challenge there, in often cases, is they don't distribute themselves evenly around the landscape. Some areas will get over-impacted, others won't get grazed enough, and you get plants that get eaten too low, and then as they're recovering and they're this tender regrowth, they often get eaten again and then again. And you can see where this goes. You end up killing the plants, leading to bare spots, and then you get hard crusted soil and you get weeds. And over time, those spots spread and the problems just get exacerbated.
Yeah.
So by bunching the cattle into small areas, you replicate the predator pressure that would have been provided that would have kept the animals together and moving. So you can do that with fencing. If you create a small paddock within the entire area that you're grazing, and then after sometimes it's a day, sometimes it's a few days or even a week, you're moving to a new paddock. You're oftentimes it's moving a portable electric fencing, moving to a new area, and then another, and then another, and then another. And that first area where you first grazed might get 30, 60, 90. In some places, they're doing up to 180 days of recovery or rest.
I'm going to read just the log line of the series. It reads as the Profiles in Land and Management series features the work of innovative ranchers and land managers who are achieving economic and ecological benefit on working lands. And my question around that is how this, that sequence of steps, that approach, that proper approach of understanding the proper amount of time that animals are going to be rotationally grazing or pulse grazing on those environments is a challenge, because every year, depending on the environmental conditions, the rain you get, how long they've been there in the past, you have to adapt your strategy. How did you see some of these different producers assessing that and appreciating that in their management practice?
So you're right. Adaptive management or adaptive grazing is what many people call this, because while it's important to start the grazing season with a plan, it needs to be able to be flexible to shift over time, because you don't know in what you're going to get for weather, for example. You don't know how the vegetation is necessarily going to respond or what issues are going to crop up. So you might end up with a big weed infestation in a place. You might end up with a flood. One of the sites I talked to in the Sacramento River Valley in California ends up with seasonal flooding, and the producers have to pull their cattle off. I mean, there goes the plan. You got to reinvent it. You got to shift it around constantly.
Yeah, it's a challenge, right? And when you're dealing with these large swaths of land, they have the little microclimates as well, right? I mean, you have low-lying areas, high areas, and you have to figure out that adaptive strategy depending on different segments or paddocks that you're dealing with.
Right. And every one of these producers or agency staff that I spoke with stressed the importance of their relationship with the private grazers. They're not dictating everything for the grazers, and the grazers aren't calling all the shots either. They're developing things in partnership. So there's really important that they have a back and forth communication, that the agency staff are clear about what their goals are, and that the producers are clear about what their needs are. And by understanding each other, and oftentimes these are people that are very different backgrounds, different experience. The agency staff may not know much at all, mostly won't know that much about grazing. And the grazers mostly won't know that much about the wildlife management and the parks management that these agency staff are experts in.
Interesting. Doran Cox says, it's not rocket science. It's much more complicated.
Yeah.
So I just want to mention, we've welcomed some of the grazing gurus like Alan Savory, Bill Nyman, Rich Shin, land management and restoration expert like Fred Kirschman, William Ferwerda of Common Land, Gabe Brown, and land access innovators like John Piotti and Bill Buckner, A.G. Caramora, Lucas St. Clair, who's even looking at taking these common lands for high net worth individuals and how to engage them in a different way, make this a succession plan. Pretty cool innovations. But is the goal of this profile series to highlight the potential impact if evaluated as a whole solution, as turnkey solutions? If you put all those things together and you make this plan moving forward, are you trying to make individuals aware within the industry and abroad that, you know, here's some positive impact that can come out from all different attributes?
So the goal is to raise the visibility of these individuals and these projects, these people, these places that are using grazing, agencies that are using grazing as a tool to achieve their management goals. So it's important that the grazing is part of a plan, it's a solution for providing disturbance. And there's so much variation across the country that the goals of that grazing are going to vary hugely. And even in the group that I interviewed, I mean, we talked about the goat grazing and the restoration there. Other places are dealing with fire risk or bird habitat or wanting to improve the water cycle or the grassland health or the wildlife health or the vegetation. They're talking about salamanders, tiger salamanders that live around the ponds in California in the Hollister Hills State Park. And that when they take the grazing away, the tiger salamander populations die out, that they need the grazing impact. In Missouri, they're using grazing to provide bird habitat. They found that there's so much rain in Missouri that, and it's such a strong growing season, that the grasses get really thick and tall and lush. And the word this guy, Max Allegor, used was they get decadent. That's, I guess, a term in the wildlife biology realm. But the Department of Conservation in Missouri has found that by using grazing, they're able to replicate the disturbance, the historical disturbance in that area in the southeast, provided by wildfires and herds of wild grazers. Today, Missouri has neither of those. Fires are controlled, the wild grazers are mostly gone. So Missouri Department of Conservation is using a mix of controlled fire and grazing to maintain the health of the grassland. It's a method called patch burn grazing. And what they need to create is a mosaic of habitat. If you mow your lawn, for example, it's all the same height. And that would provide disturbance, but it provides an even disturbance across the landscape. So what this Department of Conservation is doing is they have little patches here and there. They will burn one third of each of their of these 18 properties that they are using for the patch burn grazing method. They'll burn a third, and the other two thirds will have rest. And that third, the grazing attention, the cattle will focus their grazing on that one third where the regrowth a few weeks after the fire is very strong. It's the growth just pops back up really fast, and it's these tender, like baby salad greens. The cattle love it. So they naturally, just by instinct and preference, most of the grazing pressure will be congregated on that third that's been burned, leaving the rest of it a chance to recover.
Interesting. Yeah, and their noses are extremely powerful. I mean, they can pick up that sweet grass or what they're...
Right.
In the same way we get hungry for things or have desirability, they too, right? I mean, there are these ruminants have the ability to have access.
The importance there for the birds is some species of grassland birds need to have very short grass for their nests. Others want medium grass, others want tall grass. And then even some of the birds that need tall grass for the nests... for cover, they want to then have open areas for the chicks to be able to learn to walk and to sort of start fledging from the nest. So you need to have a variety of different heights of grasses and densities of grasses for bird species to thrive. And grazing provides that.
Okay. I don't know what you're talking about here, Greg. From my understanding from our president, to stop fires, you have to sweep the forest floor. That's what you have to do. Like, that was the only solution.
Rake.
Yeah, rake it.
The forest floor.
Excuse me. Just manual labor out there. That's where we'll put people to work, right there.
That's right. Jobs program.
There it is. Yeah. Boom. There it is. Well, let's talk a little bit about maybe your impetus for getting into this, which is interesting. So you also, part of your bio is you also direct $1.5 million of grant making program for the Cedar Tree Foundation that supports U.S. nonprofits in sustainable agriculture, food system reform, conservation, and environmental health. I also read that you work to develop and execute an individual grant making programs, and you also sit on the advisory board for New England based organization Land for Good. What got you interested in this space of grazing and ecological services and the whole systems thinking in the first place?
When I was 18 and I was hiking out west as part of a National Outdoor Leadership School program, I had a formative experience with grazing on public lands. Our group passed through a gate in a fence. We were in Utah, actually, in what's now known as the Escalante National Monument. Back then, it was not a monument. So we passed through a gate in a fence, and on one side of the fence, we just walked through this area that was green and lush and wet and beautiful and wild, natural, beautiful. The other side was ugly. It was trashed. There were hoof prints in the mud and just trampled vegetation, and the difference was just shocking. Grazing had trashed this piece of public land. And from that moment, I was sold on the idea that grazing was bad for public lands. And that rings true. That message is repeated in many places, that the problem with beef, the problem with grazing. And there are many people who would like to see grazing kicked off public lands altogether. 25 years later, my experience has evolved, or my perspective has evolved. And I see grazing like a hammer. It's a tool that can be used to build things or to tear them down. It all depends on how the tool is used. So we're quick to blame ranchers and cattle for grazing damage, and sometimes that's justified. But we also need to look at the alternative. Not grazing is also a problem in many landscapes, especially those that evolved with the disturbance that we've been talking about, the disturbance from the herds of wild grazing animals.
Fascinating. Yeah, it's no matter what, it comes down to our involvement, either taking them off or doing it improperly, right? So now is our opportunity to get back to those systems-based approach and to integrate animals back into our practices of dealing with climate change, sea level rise, all of these things.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. The public lands play an important part of that, because these profiles demonstrate opportunity for public lands to partner with individuals, to provide more land access to our producers who are working hard, and to benefit the public lands.
What's next for these profiles on land and management series? When will they be released, and when can our listening audience be able to read these and view these profiles?
Yeah, the release is scheduled for the end of the summer. I've been doing a series. I've got 6 of the public lands profiles. There's another 10 that are on private lands, profiles of adaptive grazing and regenerative grazing on private lands across the country. And we're scheming the exact launch details, and there'll be a series of blog posts. We're talking about an award for some of the managers. TBD.
Okay, so I will, when it becomes available, I'll put a write-up or a link on the profile of our conversation. We'll leave it as TBD until then.
Great, thank you.
Of course. So is there a location where our listening audience can learn a bit more about some of the other things you're involved in? Are you active on social media? Is there a good place, or do you kind of remain behind the scenes and get out on site more so than in the public eye?
Yeah, I've mostly been behind the scenes, but I would point people to, if you want to just learn about the issues, there's a great group called the No Regrets Initiative that's attached to the Globetrotter Foundation, one of our peers. The Regenerative Agriculture Foundation does post sometimes on Twitter, and there's some good content there. Otherwise, Tomcat Ranch has lots of good resources and is coming out with more and more all the time. So yeah, you can look to them as the source. They'll be hosting a lot of these profiles on their website. And they actually have quite an active on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, they have quite a research center and institute out there. And they also, which will be intriguing to some of our producer listeners, is that they also run a beef operation, Left Coast Beef, to right. integrate that into making this a pragmatic approach to getting more stakeholders involved.
Right.
Well, I'll just close by saying, whether you're a giver, investor, policymaker, or an eater, as Greg said, it all comes down to how we're treating our soil. And I love the terminology used of it's solutions for providing disturbance, of replicating how things were done in natural order before our involvement of taking these animals off in the grazing situation off the lands, and looking at it that when implemented on the 2.2 billion acres, or even a tenth of that, maybe even a hundredth of that, what could that really represent for the U.S. and being a thought leader in actually looking at banking this carbon back into our living soils and the benefits for all the different stakeholders involved? The mosaic of habitat, the biodiversity that comes with it, and the values we get out of it as consumers and eaters it's an opportunity for us to be an agents of change as a generation. So Greg Horner, I thank you so much for taking the time to come in and share wisdom with our listening audience. I learned a great deal. I know they will as well. So thanks for taking the time.
Thanks so much for having me.